Journal of Ethics and Social Philosophy, Volume 29, Number 2, January 2025. Crime, Public Health and Inhumane Objectivity, Nadine Elzane. The idea that we should reject retributivism and treat crime as a public health problem seems, at least prima facie, like an appealing stance. In recent years, it has been forcefully defended by Greg Caruso and Dirk Pareboom. Footnote 1. Caruso, Free Will Skepticism and Criminal Behaviour, Public Health and Safety and Rejecting Retributivism. Caruso and Pareboom, A Non-Punitive Alternative to Retributive Punishment. Pareboom and Caruso, Hard Incompatibilist Existentialism. And Pareboom, Living Without Free Will, Incapacitation, Reintegration and Limited General Deterrence, and Free Will, Agency and Meaning in Life. End of footnote. Many of the basic principles of the view have also been defended by Erin Kelly. Footnote 2. Kelly, The Limits of Blame and Criminal Justice Without Retribution. End of footnote. Plausibly, retributive policies presuppose basic desert, and there are reasons to doubt that agents can be assumed to be basically deserving of punishment for their wrongdoings. But even those who are not doubtful about basic desert may think that that public protection is a more important goal than enacting retribution. And these goals often conflict. Highly retributive systems typically do a worse job with respect to public protection than more forward-focused systems. Footnote 3. I am more optimistic about the possibility of basic desert than Caruso or Pareboom. I think it is possible that we are sometimes retributively responsible for our choices, and on those occasions we may be blamable to the extent of the moral disparity between the alternatives we could have chosen between. See Elzane, Undetermined Choices, Luck and the Enhancement Problem. But both the certainty and the extent of freedom are, on this model, more limited than ordinarily assumed. Following Vargas, I'm sceptical about whether we could trace responsibility for all of our choices back to occasional choices for which we are directly responsible. See Vargas, The Trouble with Tracing. End of footnote. Caruso puts forward policy recommendations inspired by the public health model. Footnote 4. Caruso, Free Will Skepticism and Criminal Behaviour and Public Health and Safety. These are supported by both evidence and common sense. There are, unsurprisingly, few critiques of these recommendations in the literature. Yet, whenever discussion arises about the possibility of crime being treated as a public health problem, I find that the idea meets with the resistance. For many, this suggestion rings alarm bells. This is partly because the project of, page 2, treating crime as a health problem has a dark history, and partly because of the worry that there is something impersonal or dehumanising about approaches to crime that weaken the emphasis on personal responsibility. Nonetheless, I will argue that this fear is misplaced. In what follows, I am going to argue for 5 claims. Claim 1. There is a difference between taken responsibility and retributive desert. Skepticism about retributive desert does not entail skepticism about either the existence of taken responsibility or about its moral importance. Claim 2. The ability to take responsibility is essential to our sense of personhood, and when we undermine the abilities that underscore taken responsibility or prevent an agent from having the opportunity to take responsibility, this is commonly experienced as dehumanising, so practices that do either unnecessarily are unethical. Claim 3. Skepticism about basic desert, as entailed by the public health model and Caruso's policy suggestions, is not dehumanising in any comparable way, except where it is, needlessly, coupled with skepticism about the existence or the moral importance of taken responsibility. Claim 4. Medical approaches to crime have often been unethical historically, because medical practices in general have often been unethical. They have often involved unnecessarily undermining an agent's capacity or opportunity to exercise taken responsibility. Claim 5. Instead of rejecting a public health approach to crime, we should seek to take a more ethical approach to public health, one that reflects a respect for taken responsibility and therefore avoids practices that are dehumanising, both in the context of crime and in that of public health more broadly. In section 1, I will give a brief outline of the public health quarantine model and of Caruso's policy suggestions. In section 2, I will argue for claims 1 and 2. I will show that impersonal or dehumanising treatment comes from undermining taken responsibility and that this need not follow from scepticism about retributivism. In section 3, I will address some objections to non-retributive and public health models, all of which draw broadly on accusations that such treatment would be in some way dehumanising. And I will argue for claim 3, scepticism about retributive desert, and Caruso's policy suggestions in particular, need not be dehumanising in the way sceptical approaches to responsibility are often accused of being. In section 4, I will briefly consider the history of the association between crime and public health, making a case for claim 4, the claim that unethical practices in medicine have been commonly, but not uniquely, page 3, associated with medicalising deviance or criminality. In section 5, I will argue for claim 5. We ought to approach medicine more ethically instead of excluding criminality from the realm of public health. 1. The public health quarantine model. For Caruso and Pareboom, the public health model of dealing with crime is motivated by free will scepticism. Footnote 5. Caruso, Free Will Scepticism and Criminal Behaviour, Public Health and Safety, and Rejecting Retributivism. Caruso and Pareboom, a non-punitive alternative to retributive punishment. Pareboom and Caruso, Hard Incompatibilist Existentialism, and Pareboom, Living Without Free Will, Incapacitation, Reintegration, and Limited General Deterrence, and Free Will, Agency, and Meaning in Life. End of footnote. What both take to be centrally in dispute between free will sceptics and their opponents is basic desert. This is the sort of responsibility that is relevant to desert of retributive blame or praise. There are various reasons why we might blame or praise an agent, but insofar as they are basically deserving, our reasons do not rest on any further good that might result from it. It is scepticism about responsibility in this sense that motivates the public health quarantine model and Caruso's policy suggestions. In his 2017 book, Public Health and Safety, Caruso gives a thorough analysis of the social determinants of crime and public health, drawing on considerable empirical evidence. Footnote 6, Caruso, Public Health and Safety, end of footnote. He proposes 8 areas in which we could adopt policies that would enable us to deal with crime more effectively without relying on the assumption of basic retributive desert. These are summarised at the end of the discussion as follows. 1. Invest in programmes and policies aimed at reducing poverty, homelessness, abuse and domestic violence. 2. Increase funding for mental health services with a focus on the early and active treatment of mental illness. 3. Secure universal access to affordable and consistent healthcare for all. 4. Reject retributivism and purely punitive approaches to criminal justice and shift the focus to prevention, rehabilitation and reintegration. 5. End all policies that disenfranchise ex-offenders, making it more difficult for them to reintegrate back into society. 6. Prioritise and properly fund education, especially in low-income areas, and support educational programmes in prison. Page 4. 7. Adopt policies that protect the environmental health of our communities by combating climate change, protecting air and water, and reducing/eliminating harmful toxins. 8. Research more effective interventions and rehabilitation strategies for psychopathy. Footnote 7. Caruso, Public Health and Safety, 20, 21, 24 and 26. End of footnote. Since present public health failures often worse affect those who are already unfairly disadvantaged by factors such as class, race, ethnicity, lifestyle and culture, Caruso proposes policies that are informed by an ethical awareness of issues of social justice. His ethical framework involves taking a capabilities approach to public well-being, grounded in Amartya Sen's idea of enabling people to function so as to protect the substantive freedom a person has to lead the kind of life he or she has reason to value. Footnote 8. Sen, Development as Freedom, page 87, quoted in Caruso, Public Health and Safety, page 19, end of footnote. Acknowledging this ethical commitment will be important for what follows. Discomfort about treating crime as a public health problem apparently does not derive from unease about the specific reforms Caruso recommends, which have attracted little criticism. Some critics proclaim to be broadly supportive of some of these policy reforms, but sceptical about whether Caruso's ethical commitments are consistent with his scepticism about free will. Footnote 9. Levi, Let's Not Do Responsibility Skepticism, and Lemos, Free Will's Value, page 148-72. End of footnote. And while few have attacked Caruso's view directly, there is a body of criticism predating Caruso's work that continues to be influential within free will literature and that captures the basic motivations for continued unease about the association between crime and public health. These will be discussed in section 4. When theorists talk about moral responsibility, it is not always clear what the term is taken to mean. While Pareboom and Caruso are careful to specify that they are concerned solely with basic retributive desert, commentators do not always clearly address the relation between retributive responsibility and broader uses of the term responsible. In the following section, I will distinguish three different senses in which we might use the term responsibility and will make a case for supposing that one variety of responsibility, what I call taken responsibility or future-directed commitment, need not stand and fall with basic retributive desert. Page 5. 2. Retributive desert versus future-directed commitment. 2.1. Three types of responsibility. The terms free will and moral responsibility lend themselves to several interpretations. Watson contrasts two notions of responsibility. The self-disclosure view captures attributability or the aretaic face of moral responsibility. In contrast, accountability captures the sort of responsibility that justifies desert of praise or blame. Footnote 10, Watson, Two Faces of Responsibility. End of footnote. We may contrast both of these with a virtue sense of the term, frequently associated with taking responsibility and less frequently discussed in relation to free will. 2.1.1, Accountability or Retributive Desert. Being responsible in the accountability sense entails being basically deserving of blame or praise. Holding someone retributively responsible entails blaming and praising or punishing and rewarding just on the basis that it is deserved. This is what would be required to justify the retributive stance. We're justified in punishing wrongdoers just on the basis that they deserve it. Caruso and Pareboom endorse scepticism solely about responsibility in this sense. There is considerable disagreement among philosophers about what conditions an agent must meet in order to have this variety of responsibility. footnote 11. Conditions for retributive responsibility range from supposing that it merely requires that our actions are conscious, intentional, rational and uncompelled, see Morse, compatibilist criminal law, to supposing that it requires us to be miracle-working, godlike beings, see Waller, Virtue Unrewarded, pages 433 to 34. End of footnote. 2.1.2 Attributability or Self-Disclosure. The features that ground attributability are reflected in various compatibilist or partially compatibilist accounts. Actions may be attributable to agents to varying degrees depending on such factors as whether the agent performed the action deliberately. Footnote 12, Hobbes of Liberty and Necessity, and Hume, A Treatise of Human Nature, section 2.3.1-2, and 2.57-65, and An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, section 8, pages 148-64. End of footnote. The agent was acting on desires that she endorsed through second-order volitions. Footnote 13, Frankfurt, Freedom of the Will and the Concept of a Person. End of footnote. The agent's second-order volitions reflected her deepest, almost wholeheartedly embraced system of values. Footnote 14, Watson, Free Agency. End of footnote. Page 6. The agent's deeper values were not misguided or were at least shaped by reasoned reflection. Footnote 15, Wolf, Freedom Within Reason, especially pages 67 to 93, end of footnote. Or the agent's mechanism of decision-making was adequately reasons responsive. Footnote 16, Fisher and Revisa, Responsibility and Control, end of footnote. These features capture whether an agent's actions express her true intentions, character, and values, and whether these values are embraced through rational reflection, as opposed to being picked up thoughtlessly or through blind indoctrination. This indicates that an agent's choices are a true reflection of the sort of person that she is. Classically, agents are exempted or excused from responsibility in the attributability sense, either because the agent lacks the general capacities required to perform actions that are attributable to her. For example, she lacks the ability to reason about her values or to reliably translate her values into choices and actions, or because the action does not reflect the true character and values of the agent. The former category may include some addicts, the severely mentally ill, or children. The latter category may include actions performed accidentally, involuntarily, or through ignorance. It is less clear that there is a distinctive attributability sense in which we might hold agents responsible, though attributability seems essential to certain practices. For example, rewards and punishments aimed solely at incentivizing good behavior or disincentivizing bad behavior make sense only when aimed at agents who meet the conditions of attributability. We usually cannot incentivize someone to do something involuntarily. 2.1.3 Taken Responsibility or Future-Directed Commitment. Gaydon contrasts the virtue sense of responsibility with the capacity sense. Footnote 17, Gaydon, Rehabilitating Responsibility. End of footnote. Watson's two senses of responsibility both seem to fall into the capacity category. The capacity senses of responsible are contrasted with not responsible, whereas the virtue sense of responsible is contrasted with irresponsible. Footnote 18, Gaydon, Rehabilitating Responsibility, page 27. End of footnote. If we think about being able to take responsibility on a model akin to developing a virtue, this raises questions about how we develop this virtue, how we educate children to develop it, and how those who have developed corresponding vice might cultivate it. Taking responsibility is normally done prospectively and hence is predominantly forward-looking in a way that retributive responsibility is not. Dorrit de Ruyter notes that a person who takes responsibility for the well-being of, page 7, another tries to establish something, whereas a person who is responsible for her action is accountable for something she has already done or for something she should have done. Footnote 19, de Ruyter, The Virtue of Taking Responsibility, page 26, end of footnote. Bruce Waller uses the term take charge responsibility for something like this virtue sense. Footnote 20, Waller, Against Moral Responsibility, page 105, end of footnote. Perboom and Caruso also explicitly distinguish taking responsibility in the sense of sincerely committing to a task with the sort of responsibility relevant to basic deserts of blame or praise. Footnote 21, Perboom, Living Without Free Will, page 21 of the introduction, and Caruso and Perboom, Moral Responsibility Reconsidered, pages 3 to 4, end of footnote. An agent takes responsibility when they exhibit future-directed commitment. An agent exhibits future-directed commitment only insofar as they are willing and able to commit prospectively, sincerely and conscientiously to a project or aim. When we attribute the virtues of being a responsible person to someone, we are saying that that person reliably exhibits future-directed commitment, particularly where they are morally required to do so. When we describe someone as irresponsible, we are saying that they do not reliably exhibit future-directed commitment, especially where this involves moral negligence. A responsible person is one who can be relied upon to take responsibility when it is called for. I will use the terms future-directed commitment and taken responsibility interchangeably. The latter is more in keeping with common usage, while the former better marks the distinction between this concept and responsibility of the sort that's usually in dispute in debates about free will. De Ruyter outlines a number of abilities required for an agent to count as responsible in the virtue sense. These include rationality, because one has to be able to interpret the needs of others and to reflect on one's possible responses, caring about the needs of others, and having the willpower to act on this, even when we have countervailing interests. Footnote 22, De Ruyter, The Virtue of Taking Responsibility, pages 28 to 30, end of footnote. When we talk about holding an agent responsible in the sense that corresponds to this sort of responsibility, this involves expecting the agent to take responsibility. For example, expecting her to exhibit a future-directed commitment to behave better in future or to make amends for something done previously. This expectation need not involve retributive blame. If we call it blame at all, it may be something closer to T.M. Scanlon's non-punitive form of blame. Footnote 23, Scanlon, Interpreting Blame, end of footnote. But it is better captured by Hannah Pickard's notion of responsibility without blame. Pickard argues that this way of holding agents responsible is effective in improving behaviour in both therapeutic, page 8, contexts and criminal justice contexts. Footnote 24. Pickard, Responsibility Without Blame, Empathy and Effective Treatment of Personality Disorder. Responsibility Without Blame, Therapy, Philosophy, Law, and Rethinking Justice. End of footnote. When we hold someone responsible in this sense, the goal is not to blame them, but to foster the sorts of reflection that might enable them to better exhibit future-directed commitment. Two questions arise here. The first is the question of what the relation is between future-directed commitment and the two capacity senses of responsibility. The second is the question of whether we can endorse scepticism about retributive desert without endorsing scepticism about one or both of the others. 2.2. The relation between senses of responsibility. I want to suggest that while some degree of attributability is necessary in order for an agent to be able to take responsibility, these two sorts of responsibility are only weakly connected. It is not necessary at all that an agent meets the conditions of accountability or basic retributive desert in order to exhibit future-directed commitment of the sort required for taken responsibility. Waller points out that while it is often assumed that take charge responsibility suffices for being responsible in the sense that justifies blame and praise, this assumption is unjustified. Establishing that someone has take charge responsibility still leaves open the question of whether they would be blameworthy or praiseworthy for what they have done. Footnote 25. Waller, Against Moral Responsibility, pages 104 to 14. End of footnote. It might seem, on the face of it, that one cannot be entailed by the other, since one of these essentially involves a future-directed mindset, while the other is backward-looking. While the future-directed commitment that characterises taking responsibility is something we exercise prospectively, it can also have a backward-looking aspect. When an agent is described as taking responsibility for a past action, this involves committing to future actions that express a willingness to make amends for it or to repair damage done by it. But this need not entail being retributively responsible. David Enoch notes that we may be able to take responsibility for something we have previously done, even when we are not to blame for it at all. Footnote 26, Enoch, Being Responsible, Taking Responsibility and Penumbral Agency. End of footnote. Consider cases of agent regret of the sort described by Bernard Williams in the face of bad moral luck. For example, a driver blamelessly hitting a pedestrian. Footnote 27, Williams, Moral Luck. End of footnote. Such cases suggest an ability precisely to exhibit future-directed commitment in relation to actions that were outside of our control by adopting a willingness to make recompense. Here, the agent is neither attributively accountable nor even attributable, except perhaps to a weak degree. We would not regard the... Page 9... as someone who deserves to suffer in proportion to the harm that they have caused, even if we think it is not out of place for them to actively take responsibility by adopting a future-directed commitment to make amends. Children may also be able to take responsibility for things despite not being retributively blamable if they fail. When a parent asks a child to take responsibility for feeding the hamster, the parent is certainly expecting the child to exhibit future-directed commitment. But they need not suppose that were the child to fail and were the parent to end up having to feed the pet after all, the child would deserve to suffer retributively. If the parent scolds the child for it, any suffering would naturally be regarded as an instrumental rather than an intrinsic good. Where an agent exhibits future-directed commitment or takes responsibility for something despite not being retributively responsible for it, she must still possess certain abilities. The ability to care about something, to be sensitive to reasons, and to exercise strength of will. This suggests that some degree of attributability is required even if retributive desert is not. But this is true only to a weak degree. Children can exhibit future-directed commitment despite the fact that they do not fully meet the conditions typically associated with attributability, since they lack mature capacities of reason and reflection, do not have a fully developed set of values, and do not reliably succeed in translating their underdeveloped values into choices and actions. While a child who takes responsibility may perform actions that are attributable to her, she does not count as the sort of agent to whom the conditions of attributability generally apply. In contrast, the blameless but unlucky driver is the sort of agent to whom actions are typically attributable, but in this particular instance, the action is not attributable to them. The driver has fully developed capacities for reason and reflection and can typically translate their values into choices and actions. But this particular action was accidental and not a true reflection of their values and intentions. It seems impossible that an agent could exhibit future-directed commitment with respect to something if neither the agent nor the relevant actions qualified as attributable to some degree. So some degree of attributability is required for taken responsibility. But neither the child nor the unlucky driver would usually be thought to be fully responsible in the attributability sense. The capacity to take responsibility is distinct, then, from both attributability and retributive desert, even if it is weakly connected to the former. 2.3. Skepticism and incompatibilist doubts. For free will skeptics, the capacities associated with attributability are not sufficient for basic retributive desert. And it should be uncontroversial for all sides that the capacities required for taking responsibility or exhibiting, page 10, future-directed commitment do not suffice for retributive desert. We need retributive desert in order to justify the retributive view that it would be an intrinsic good for guilty parties to suffer in proportion to their intentional wrongdoing just because it is deserved. Skeptical worries typically arise in relation to perceived threats to free will, such as causal determinism, randomness, or pessimism about either one. The argument for regarding these as threats typically draws either on concerns about leeway, whether an agent is capable of choosing otherwise, or else on concerns about ultimate sourcehood, whether any agent is the ultimate source of her own choices, where one or both are taken to be further preconditions of retributive desert. The arguments for scepticism about retributive desert do not rest on scepticism about whether any agent meets the conditions of attributability, whether, for instance, any agent is acting on purpose or really endorses the desires that motivate her. Even if we are acting on our deeply held values, if these are ultimately explained by factors entirely outside of our control, skeptics argue that this renders punishment purely for the sake of retribution morally suspect. Skepticism about retributive blame neither rests on nor entails skepticism about attributability. Opponents of skepticism typically suppose that if an agent meets the conditions of attributability, this is sufficient for their meeting the conditions of retributive desert too. Skeptics deny this. Skepticism is usually motivated by some form of incompatibilism with respect to retributive desert, traditionally seeing it as ruled out by determinism, though skeptics may be concerned that it is ruled out by indeterminism too. But even those who are incompatibilists about retributive desert are typically willing to accept compatibilism about attributability. They simply argue that compatibilism about attributability does not suffice to establish compatibilism about retributive desert. While our standard desert-entailing practices seem to presuppose that attributability suffices for attributive desert, skeptics endorse revision of these practices and will therefore suppose that their validity cannot be taken for granted. It would be unfair to punish someone just for the sake of retribution if her choices are ultimately fixed by factors outside of her control. This need not entail that there is no difference, say, between actions performed voluntarily and those that are coerced. It just means that acting voluntarily is not sufficient for basic desert. It may be a necessary condition, but it cannot be a sufficient one, since there are further necessary conditions, i.e. requirements of sourcehood or leeway, that may or may not be met. While there is some controversy about whether compatibilism about attributability suffices for compatibilism about retributive desert, it should be far, page 11, less contentious to say that the sort of incompatibilist challenge that prompts scepticism about retributive desert entail no corresponding scepticism about taken responsibility, since agents can exhibit future-directed commitment without fully meeting the conditions of attributability, let alone meeting any further conditions potentially required for retributive desert. Agents like the child or the unlucky driver will not count as retributively blameworthy, even by traditional compatibilist standards. Given these ambiguities, it is important to keep in mind the distinction between different senses of responsibility when assessing the implications of responsibility scepticism. It seems plausible that scepticism about taken responsibility would have terrible implications. But sceptics about retributive desert do not even endorse scepticism about attributability. They certainly do not and need not accept scepticism about taken responsibility. 2.4. Responsibility and personhood. In defending sense capacity model of well-being, Caruso emphasises protecting the substantive freedom a person has to lead the kind of life he or she has reason to value. Footnote 28, Caruso, Public Health and Safety, page 19, end of footnote. This use of the word freedom does not entail retributive responsibility. But it does plausibly entail placing moral and practical importance on protecting and encouraging certain capabilities, including those that enable us to exhibit future-directed commitment. The skills required for taking responsibility are important for a range of reasons that are unconnected to retributive desert. Future-directed commitment is essential to our sense of personhood, such that if this is undermined, it's experienced as dehumanising. Taking responsibility is central to our sense of self-efficacy or our command over our future behaviour. We task children with taking responsibility when we are on the cusp of beginning to treat them as persons. When we do not allow an adult to take responsibility, this is experienced as patronising. My claim below is that respect for personhood requires respect for the capacities that underscore taken responsibility or future-directed commitment. 3. Scepticism and dehumanisation. In this section, I will explore a collection of key worries that seem to underscore unease about public health approaches to crime, focusing on four arguments in particular. Peter Strawson's worries about alienating objectivity, Herbert Morris's concerns about personhood and the right to be punished, Peter Conrad's, page 12, worries about the medicalisation of deviant, and Ken Levi's criticism of Caruso's free will scepticism. Footnote 29. Strawson, Freedom and Resentment. Morris, Persons and Punishment. Conrad, Medicine as an Instrument of Social Control. And Levi, Let's Not Do Responsibility Scepticism. End of footnote. While these arguments present diverse considerations, there is a common thread underlying them. They all, in some way or other, presuppose that there is something dehumanising, either about responsibility scepticism or about medicine-related approaches to crime, or both. Between them, I think these represent the main categories of argument that motivate unease regarding the public health quarantine model. I hope to show that there is another common thread between them. They all, to some extent, presuppose that scepticism about retributive desert and or medicalised approaches to deviant behaviour must undermine taken responsibility as well. The assumption is essential to motivating the idea that such approaches are impersonal and dehumanising. I want to argue, A, that we need not accept this assumption, as scepticism about retributive desert does not entail scepticism about taken responsibility. B, that when we reject it, the public health approach no longer appears dehumanising. And C, that Caruso's policies in particular are not dehumanising in any of the ways suggested by these lines of argument. 3.1. The objective attitude. Objections to treating crime as a public health problem often come from a Strawsonian outlook. Strawson argues that scepticism about responsibility and a suspension of backwards-looking attitudes would be alienating. He equates holding others responsible with seeing them as appropriate targets of reactive attitudes, i.e. the attitudes and reactions of offended parties and beneficiaries, of such things as gratitude, resentment, forgiveness, love and hurt feelings. Footnote 30, Strawson, Freedom and Resentment, page 5, end of footnote. These mark an attitude of involvement or participation, which we adopt with those that we hold morally responsible. Footnote 31, Strawson, Freedom and Resentment, page 9, end of footnote. In contrast, when we do not hold a person morally responsible, we adopt a more detached attitude, suspending feelings connected to social demands and expectations. We do not engage with the agent as a person. Rather, we see him perhaps as an object of social policy, as a subject for what, in a wide range of senses, might be called treatment, as something certainly to be taken account, perhaps precautionary account of, to be managed or handled or cured or trained, perhaps simply to be avoided. Footnote 32. Strawson, Freedom and Resentment, page 9, end of footnote. This plausibly captures what is objectionable about denying an agent's responsibility. It is not entirely clear, page 13, what Strawson means by viewing someone objectively. Footnote 33. On this point, see Tadros, Treatment and Accountability, end of footnote. But the key idea is that being subject to treatment or being managed or handled or cured or trained involves being treated in an objectionably impersonal manner. The contrast can be nicely illustrated by reflecting on the plot of Anthony Burgess's novel A Clockwork Orange, famously adapted to film by Stanley Kubrick. Alex, a violent criminal, is subjected to two approaches to dealing with convicted criminals, one backward-looking and retributive, and the other forward-looking and non-retributive. First, he is placed in a standard prison. It is grotty and unpleasant. He's treated with moral contempt by the prison guards, who enforce a regime of punishment and hold him accountable for his actions. The prison chaplain frequently talks to him and reasons with him. This captures what Strawson calls the attitude of involvement or participation. Alex is seen as an appropriate target for attitudes like resentment and blame. Alex is then taken out of this institution and placed in another one. The second institution is a nice shiny clinic. Here he is intermittently subjected to a program of conditioning whereby he is forced to watch films of violence while given a drug that makes him feel like he is suffocating. A plot no doubt inspired by real life examples in which criminals were conditioned with drugs such as succinylcholine chloride. Footnote 34. We'll return to these non-fictional examples in section 4 below. End of footnote. The goal is to produce an aversion to violence, rendering his future behaviour harmless. In this institution, Alex is not blamed or resented, merely, as Strawson puts it, managed or handled or cured or trained. He is rarely spoken to, since his thoughts are largely irrelevant to what they're doing. This seems a good illustration of Strawson's objective outlook. The fact that this attitude seems dehumanising is also reflected in the novel, with Alex's anguished plea. Me, me, how about me? Where do I come into all of this? Am I just like some animal or dog? Footnote 35, Burgess, A Clockwork Orange, page 104. The worry is that adopting an impersonal attitude across the board would be dehumanising for us all. While this treatment gives us a clear illustration of an agent being regarded objectively in Strawson's sense, it also involves more than just a rejection of retributive blame. Alex's capacity for take and responsibility is also undermined. He's robbed of the power to exhibit future-directed commitment with respect to his own behaviour. While Alex's treatment exemplifies the sort of strained objectivity of attitude identified by Strawson, it's not obvious that such strained objectivity is entailed merely by the rejection of retributive desert. We can see this if we think about policies that involve rejecting retributivism, page 14, but retaining a strong emphasis on the capacities underlying take and responsibility. This is precisely what Caruso's positive proposals do. Conditions such as poverty, homelessness, abuse, and domestic violence are factors that can significantly undermine a person's capacity for developing and exercising take and responsibility. They undermine the ability to develop sensitivity to others or to exercise self-mastery. For example, evidence suggests that poverty makes people more impulsive and weak-willed and makes it harder to reason about the long-term consequences of one's actions. Footnote 36. Malanathan and Shafir, Scarcity, Pepper and Nettle, The Behavioural Constellation of Deprivation. End of footnote. There is clearly nothing dehumanising about taking people out of poverty. If anything, being subjected to poverty, homelessness, and abuse is dehumanising. Tackling these problems strengthens the capacity for take and responsibility rather than weakening it. On my analysis, this reflects a correspondingly strengthened rather than weakened respect for personhood. Similarly, most mental illnesses are commonly acknowledged to be a barrier to the capacities needed for future-directed commitment. So increasing provisions for early treatment and securing free healthcare for all are policies that would strengthen rather than weaken the capacity for take and responsibility. Again, this is hardly dehumanising. Caruso suggests that we ought to shift our focus from retribution to prevention, rehabilitation and reintegration. Footnote 37, Caruso, Public Health and Safety, page 21, end of footnote. Rehabilitation and reintegration essentially require helping offenders to become capable of taking on responsibilities in life outside of prison. This capacity may be best served by being encouraged to take responsibility for one's environment and take on employment roles that better mirror the outside world. Opportunities that are typically more limited in prison systems with a heavy emphasis on retribution. Similarly, education improves our capacity to think critically and make informed choices, and hence education strengthens the abilities that are central to take and responsibility. Again, it seems plausible to think that a lack of access to education rather than an increased access is dehumanising. Exposure to environmental toxins also reduces one's capacity for take and responsibility, as well as making one more vulnerable to criminality. For example, lead poisoning causes damage to the brain, which affects reasoning ability. Those who suffer from it are typically impulsive and less able to exercise self-control. Again, it is hardly dehumanising to limit the exposure risk of vulnerable populations. Finally, psychopaths tend to act more impulsively, lack self-control, and be insensitive to others' interests, and are hampered from being able to, page 15, effectively take responsibility. More research into effective interventions and rehabilitation strategies would potentially lead to an increase rather than a decrease in these abilities, and hence this policy also respects personhood. While Caruso's policy suggestions can hardly be regarded as objectifying in the way Strawson takes to be problematic, there remains a worry that the view prevents us from seeing anyone as an apt target for reactive attitudes. Pairboom suggests that we could retain some reactive attitudes, namely those that are not morally problematic, by substituting resentment or guilt with shock and disappointment or regret at being the agent of wrong. We may be able to avoid any alienating detachment. Footnote 38, Pairboom, Living Without Free Will, pages 187 to 213, and Free Will, Love and Anger. End of footnote. But it is not obvious that the reactive attitudes, even those tied to blame, like guilt or resentment, entail retributivism. Retributivism is usually understood as the view that the proportionate suffering of a wrongdoer is intrinsically good on the basis that it is deserved. Strawson never mentions retribution in his famous article, so it is not at all clear that Strawson's prime target is scepticism specifically about retributive desert, as opposed to scepticism about weaker forms of responsibility. In personal relationships, attitudes like resentment do not obviously have retributive implications. If my spouse makes a hurtful comment, feeling resentful may be an unavoidable implication of adopting the attitude of participation. But it's hardly obvious that I must thereby want my spouse to suffer, or, even if I do, that I must want this on the basis that I regard such suffering as an intrinsic good because it is deserved. In a healthy relationship, we're likely to regard any suffering that comes from expressing resentment as instrumental to fostering greater mutual understanding and empathy, rather than seeing it as a means of enacting retribution. The latter goal would normally be more naturally regarded as a sign of bitter relationship breakdown, rather than as a marker of meaningful engagement. There seems to be no central sense, then, in which scepticism about retributivism alone entails the strained objectivity of attitude that Strawson suggests would be so alienating. 3.2. The right to be punished. Morris argues that being retributively punished for our crimes is a right. If we are not held responsible as agents, our wrongdoings are inevitably seen as illness, warranting treatment rather than punishment. Footnote 39, Morris, Persons and Punishment. End of footnote. He gives four reasons for supposing that this is objectionable. First, echoing Alex's lament from A Clockwork Orange, if we are not held responsible for our behaviour, our status is reduced to that of animals. Second, it robs us of the capacity to enjoy any sense of achievement in, page 16, relation to what we do. Third, what we receive comes to us through compassion or through a desire to control us. And finally, the logic of cure will push us towards forms of therapy that inevitably involve changes in the person made against his will. Footnote 40. Morris, Persons and Punishment, page 486 to 87, end of footnote. This involves being treated like animals or machines, being controlled and manipulated, whether we consent to it or not. Moreover, Morris argues that we have the concept of cruel punishment, but not that of cruel treatment, as opposed to merely painful treatment. Hence, there is no need for procedural safeguards in medicine of the sort that we have in the legal system. Footnote 41. Morris, Persons and Punishment, page 485, end of footnote. The claim that we have a right to exercise taken responsibility would follow more plausibly from these arguments than the claim that we have a right to be retributively punished. It is not at all obvious that a failure to hold others retributively responsible has any of these implications, at least not once we see that this need not involve scepticism about the existence or the moral importance of taken responsibility. Moreover, Morris seems to endorse a picture of medical ethics according to which it's always permissible, for the sake of treatment, to bypass an agent's wishes and consent and to inflict manipulative treatment as if we are training an animal or programming a machine. But why should we suppose that this is an ethical approach even to medicine? we now recognise a range of health problems connected specifically to agency. Obesity, addiction, eating disorders, depression, anxiety disorders, obsessive compulsive disorders, etc. I would not think much of a doctor who supposed that in treating any of these conditions, it would be okay to treat patients as animals, manipulate them, or inflict treatments on them against their will. Nor is it obvious that insofar as we recognise these as illnesses, a patient who succeeds in getting through a programme of recovery is unable to feel any sense of achievement. Programmes aimed at treating addiction or obesity commonly involve marking and celebrating achievements, like meeting weight loss goals or being clean for a year. And while we may have lacked the concept of cruel treatment at the time Morris was writing, we certainly do have this concept now. Many practices that were once considered acceptable, such as forced unsedated electroconvulsive therapy, have since come to be regarded as unduly cruel, and we now recognise a need for legal safeguards. Historically, problems like addiction and obesity were thought to warrant moral contempt rather than treatment. It would be counterintuitive to regard a move away from this attitude and towards a treatment model as a violation, page 17, of anyone's rights. Illnesses relating to agency, addiction, depression, compulsion, etc., typically weaken an agent's ability to effectively assume responsibility for her own behaviour. An effective treatment may correspondingly strengthen it. If this capacity is thought to matter morally, this provides strong moral imperative not to inflict entirely manipulative fixes against an agent's will. Such moral imperatives have not always been recognised in the past, as will be explored further below. But a modern medical practitioner is unlikely to suppose that merely classifying something as a medical problem would justify inflicting painful and manipulative treatments on a patient without her consent. And once again, the abilities that underscore taken responsibility are threatened rather than strengthened by factors such as poverty, exposure to abuse, lack of mental health support and medical care, lack of education, exposure to toxins, etc. So Caruso's policy proposals certainly do not reflect Morris's picture of an impersonal or medicalised treatment, since they all aim to strengthen rather than to bypass rational agency. 3.3. Medicalising deviance. There is a long-standing worry about deviant behaviour being encompassed within the realm of medical treatment. Thomas Satz and Nicholas Kittrey each give influential early critiques to this effect, but I am going to focus on Conrad's succinct summary of some of the key dangers associated with the medicalisation of deviant, which takes into account some of the main lines of argument developed by earlier theorists. Footnote 42. Satz, Law, Liberty and Psychiatry, Kittrey, The Right to be Different, and Conrad, Medicine as an Instrument of Social Control. End footnote. Conrad identifies at least six categories of problem. Footnote 43. Conrad, Medicine as an Instrument of Social Control, pages 248 to 51. End of footnote. First, when a person is seen as ill, Conrad maintains that they are not encouraged to take responsibility. This causes a significant drop in status as they are essentially tainted with their condition and dependent on those classed as non-sick. Secondly, the use of medical language often obscures the value judgments behind medical practices, holding the moral and political agendas driving public health policy. Third, once something is classed as falling under the remit of medicine, this means it gets taken out of the realm of public debate and put into the hands of experts. Fourth, defining deviant behaviour as a medical problem allows certain things to be done that could not otherwise be considered. For example, the body may be cut open or psychiatric medications given. Footnote 44. Conrad, Medicine as an Instrument of Social Control, pages 249 to 50, end of footnote. Fifth, once we see something as a medical problem, this pushes us towards an emphasis on the individual, page 18, discouraging us from considering the social causes of the problem. Finally, the medicalisation of deviant behaviour can rob that behaviour of political meaning, removing the category of evil from our understanding of the world. Worries about the medicalising of deviant behaviour are not necessarily misplaced, but the term may be given broad or narrow readings. Read narrowly, it encompasses only policies that involve treating an individual's behaviour as an illness and seeking to alter it with treatment, ignoring the broader societal factors. This can be problematic, but the public health model does not count as medicalising crime on this narrow reading. Read broadly, the term encompasses any strategy that puts something within the broad remit of public health policy. On that reading, the public health model does count as medicalising crime, but this becomes unproblematic. Is it true that once someone is seen as ill, they are not encouraged to take responsibility and are essentially tainted with their condition? This may be true of some, although hardly all, physical ailments. But there are few courses of treatment for problems like addiction or obesity that do not essentially require an agent to take responsibility and aim to increase the degree to which an agent is able to do this. For example, cognitive behavioural talking therapies aim precisely at enabling agents to exercise future-directed commitment and to more effectively translate their wills into action. Moreover, many public health measures aimed at tackling things like obesity and addiction do not essentially taint individuals with their illnesses. Measures for tackling obesity include things like reducing the sugar and fat content in foods, putting clearer and more informative labelling on packaging, restricting advertisements for junk food on children's television, adding health and nutrition education to school curricula, removing sweets from next to the checkout in supermarkets, etc. Relatedly, the idea that individuals must be the sole focus of health interventions is somewhat outdated. For example, Virginia Chang and Nicholas Christakis have examined changes to the entry for obesity in the Cecil Textbook of Medicine over a period of 100 years and have found significant shifts over time. Footnote 47, Chang and Christakis, Medical Modelling of Obesity. End of footnote. In 1927, the focus was entirely on the individual who was also held personally responsible for overeating. In later editions, the focus shifts towards societal factors that make individuals vulnerable to obesity, such as the wide availability and aggressive marketing of junk foods. By 2000, there is also a focus on the damaging repercussions of blaming individuals for obesity, as this makes them vulnerable to victimisation and mental health problems. The picture of public healthcare in Caruso's model better reflects this trend towards taking a less individualistic approach to healthcare and addressing societal risk factors. Page 19. It is perhaps true, as Conrad contends, that the use of medical language can obscure value judgments, taking the debate out of the public sphere and putting it into the hands of experts, especially where medicalisation is construed narrowly. But it is not obvious that all matters of public health policy are like this. Measures that affect the whole public, for example, sugar and alcohol taxes, low emission zones, smoking bans, pandemic policy, etc., often spark a great deal of public debate, and the political values in dispute are often transparent. For example, it is often clear that we are weighing personal or commercial freedoms against public safety. defining something as a health problem also seems neither necessary nor sufficient for allowing procedures such as cutting open the body or administering psychoactive drugs. Cosmetic surgery involves cutting open the body to treat problems that nobody regards as illnesses, like small breasts or a crooked nose. And even when something is a medical problem, this does not automatically entail that such procedures are justified. We might think that some such procedures were never justified, for example, frontal lobe lobotomies or bloodletting. And, except in extreme cases, any procedure that goes against the wishes of a patient may be regarded as unjustifiable, even if the patient is ill. Finally, should we worry that Pareboom and Caruso's model removes the category of evil from our understanding of the world? Even if we were to regard nobody as deserving punishment aimed purely at retribution, we could still class actions that aim to harm others as morally wrong, and those that aim to cause atrocious harms as evil. But the view calls into question whether people count as evil. This is a bullet that free will sceptics are typically willing to bite. And those of us who are not sceptics, but are merely doubtful about whether we have adequate epistemic justifications for extensively attributing basic desert to others, need not suppose that no one is evil, merely that we should have limited confidence in assessing them as such. And once again, if we turn specifically to Caruso's policy suggestions, we find that they're not vulnerable to Conrad's worries. They focus predominantly on societal factors, and they aim at increasing an agent's capacity for taking responsibility rather than removing it. Again, poverty, lack of healthcare, exposure to toxins, etc., tend to weaken this capacity. So once again, these policy suggestions do not seem vulnerable to the objection. 3.4. Skepticism about skepticism. Similar themes recur in Ken Levi's recent critique of Caruso's view. Footnote 46. Levi, let's not do responsibility skepticism. End of footnote. Levi argues that given universal skepticism about desert, the traditionally recognised excuses, automatism, duress, entrapment, infancy, insanity, involuntary, page 20, intoxication, mistake of fact and mistake of law, are suddenly far too limited. Responsibility sceptics are committed to replacing the recognised excuses with a much broader excuse, a university non-responsibility excuse that applies to everyone, not because of any cognitive deficiencies or situational constraints, but simply because of metaphysical deficiency, their universal human inability to be genuinely responsible for their crimes. Footnote 47, Levi, let's not do responsibility skepticism, page 3, end of footnote. Echoing Strawson, Morris and Conrad, Levi argues that the sceptic's position is dehumanising and threatens human dignity. Most adults believe their dignity, which they value deeply, would be severely impaired by others' perception that they are not responsible for their choices and behaviour. Such impairment tends to yield devastating effects, including learned helplessness, i.e. fatalistic resignation, diminished cognitive self-efficacy, and lower self-esteem. Footnote 48, Levi, let's not do responsibility scepticism, page 4. He also supposes that Caruso's reasoning would lead to a massive increase in incarceration because it would make sense to preventatively incarcerate those who have committed no crimes so long as they fall into categories that render it likely that they will offend. For example, having pro-criminal attitudes and values, acquaintances who share these pro-criminal values, personality traits such as hostility and a lack of empathy, family problems such as childhood neglect and abuse, low educational attainment and alcohol or drug problems. Footnote 49, Levi, let's not do responsibility scepticism, page 6. Once we stop engaging with someone's behaviour as an expression of their own considered and responsible choices, it will be inevitably viewed just like any other impersonal source of danger that might be targeted with risk assessments. The fact that it is the person's own deliberate doings will lose all moral significance. Levi's claim that Caruso's scepticism about dessert entails that all of the traditionally recognised excuses must be thrown out and replaced with a universal non-responsibility excuse fails to take into account the difference between scepticism about retributive dessert, which free will sceptics are committed to, and scepticism about varying degrees of attributability and about taken responsibility, which free will sceptics are not usually committed to. These distinctions would still be incredibly important legally, given that agents can be expected or encouraged to take responsibility only for behaviour that is deliberate, informed, uncoerced, etc. Moreover, we would only have learned helplessness insofar as we are unable to prospectively take responsibility. It is not obvious that this requires being held retributively blameworthy for our past behaviour. Again, consider the move away from viewing obesity as a moral failing for which an individual should be, page 21, blamed, and towards viewing it as a medical problem that calls for effective public health measures. Most such measures presuppose an ability to prospectively take responsibility, as is the case with better package labelling and dietary education in school curricula, aim to strengthen an agent's ability to exercise strength of will, as is the case with cognitive behavioural talking therapies and support groups, or aim to limit exposure to factors which weaken an agent's ability to exercise strength of will, as is the case with, for example, regulations that limit the aggressive marketing of junk food. Throwing away taken responsibility would plausibly produce fatalistic resignation and low self-esteem, as Levi supposes. But measures aimed at strengthening an agent's capacities for taken responsibility are often at odds with measures aimed at enacting retribution. This is true in relation to crime, as well as in relation to traditional health problems. For example, those who wish to make prisons less retributive typically also wish to make them more effective for rehabilitation. In standard UK and US prisons, inmates live in austere cells, are banned from personalising their spaces, and often have more limited access to mental health support, fewer opportunities for education and training, and fewer opportunities to develop work skills. In contrast, in Norwegian prisons, which are far less focused on punitive measures, inmates are actively encouraged to take responsibility for the spaces they live in, are offered greater opportunities for education and training, and may even be given the chance to actively take on work responsibilities mirroring those of an outside workplace. Punitive systems do not necessarily do anything to encourage inmates either to take more responsibility for their environment and development, or to develop the skills that will better enable them to take responsibility on their release. If we undermine the capacity for taken responsibility, this really does create fatalistic resignation. But support for retributive blame is often, at best, completely orthogonal to encouraging and enabling greater taken responsibility, or, at worst, directly in conflict with it. Finally, if we suppose that encouraging and enabling taken responsibility is morally important, a stance that we can plausibly adopt consistent with scepticism about retributive blame, then we will have strong reasons not to incarcerate people merely on the basis that they fall into various categories associated with a higher risk of criminality. This obviously robs agents of the opportunities to prospectively take responsibility for their own future behaviour by rendering their intentions with respect to their own future behaviour irrelevant. Footnote 50. A related claim by Lemos is that if public safety is the goal, we may have reason to lower the standard of evidence required for conviction from guilt being established beyond reasonable doubt to it merely being likely on the preponderance of evidence. See Lemos, A Moral Pragmatic Defence of Just Desserts Responsibility, and Free Will's Value, page 149 to 56. This would not leave huge segments of the population powerless over their lives, as per Levi's suggestion, but it would increase the risk of having our capacities for take and responsibility undermined. If this is a serious harm in itself, then it is not clear that the safety gains will be worth the increased risk, especially if we want to promote not mere safety, but also the substantive freedom to lead the kind of life we have reason to value. End of footnote. There are also other factors that would count against this policy. Page 22, including some forward-looking considerations that Levi mentions himself, such as the fact that the resulting rage and terror that would spread throughout the community would arguably outweigh the public health benefit. Footnote 51, Levi, Let's Not Do Responsibility Skepticism, page 6, end of footnote. Moreover, most of the risk factors themselves are ones that Caruso's policies are directly aimed at tackling. Poverty, traumatic childhood experiences, addiction, poor access to education, etc. There is a big difference between policies that aim to prevent people from becoming vulnerable to these risk factors and a policy of incarcerating those who have already been exposed to them. The first strengthens an agent's ability to exhibit future-directed commitment by strengthening the ability to exercise strength of will and to make better informed and less impulsive decisions. The second, in contrast, weakens or completely removes this ability. While it is dehumanising to undermine an agent's ability to take responsibility, it is not dehumanising to withhold retributive blame, and the second stance does not entail the first. All of the theorists discussed in this section seem to share an assumption that viewing crime as a public health problem and/or rejecting retributive principles entails that we must be blind to the moral importance of the sorts of abilities that underlie take and responsibility. I have argued that there is no such entailment, and that without this entailment, accusations that this approach would justify impersonal or dehumanising treatments are baseless. If so, we might wonder where the persistent worry about this comes from. Levi acknowledges that Caruso provides moral reasons why scepticism about retributive responsibility would not justify locking up great swathes of the population who have committed no crime. But he nonetheless claims that once culpability was abandoned, such reasons would be inadequate barriers to punishment for suspected dangerousness. Given human nature, at least humans' track record for the past few centuries, it is quite likely that even a morally advanced, responsibility sceptical society would simply override these moral principles by filling in the space previously occupied by culpability with a much more robust, single-minded concern for public safety. Footnote 52, Levi, Let's Not Do Responsibility Skepticism, page 6. In fact, suspicion that treating crime as a public health problem would have dehumanising implications is certainly encouraged by the actual history of projects aimed, page 23, at treating crime and as a public health problem. Levi is justly discouraged by our track record for the past few centuries. It may be this history that continues to provoke unease. We will turn to this point next. 4. Crime, medicine and ethics. 4.1. The dark history of the association of medicine and crime. The troubling Clockwork Orange picture of what might be entailed by treating criminality. Ralph Schwitz-Gabel documents a host of behaviour modification techniques that have been used to treat offenders, including methods that draw on classical and operant conditioning. Footnote 53, Schwitz-Gabel, Development and Legal Regulation of Coercive Behaviour Modification Techniques with Offenders. End of footnote. Some rely on positive reinforcement through token economies or tier systems. Notably, however, some rely on various forms of negative reinforcement, including aversive suppression, techniques involving the administration of electric shocks or the use of succinylcholine chloride, described as a curare-like drug that rapidly produces complete paralysis of the skeletal muscles, including those which control respiration, resulting in a great fright about being unable to breathe and fear of suffocation. Footnote 54, Schwitz-Gabel, Development and Legal Regulation of Coercive Behaviour Modification Techniques with Offenders, page 10. Such negative reinforcement techniques were used to treat a great many crimes, including homosexuality, transvestitism and fetishism. Psychiatry has been used throughout history as an instrument of social control. From Samuel Cartwright's notorious diagnosis of drapetomania, the supposed disorder of slaves who wished to escape slavery, to the psychiatric internment of Soviet dissidents in the USSR. Footnote 55. Cartwright, Report on the Diseases and Physical Peculiarities of the Negro Race, and Ferrone, Psychiatry and Political Repression in the Soviet Union. End of footnote. Moran notes that medicalizing criminality has been associated with numerous morally and scientifically dubious interventions that aim to identify the born criminal, a project frequently steeped in racism and classism. 56. Moran, The Search for the Born Criminal and the Medical Control of Criminality. End of footnote. Dubious historical attempts to give medical explanations of crime include physiognomy and phrenology, both pioneered in the early 19th century. The former sought to diagnose criminality through features of the face, while the latter sought to diagnose criminality through the shape of the skull. Footnote 57. Lavater, Essays on Physiognomy, and Spurzheim, the physiognomical systems of Dr. Gall and Spurzheim. End of footnote. Some historical attempts to think, page 24, of criminality in biological terms are absurd to the point of comedy, such as Richard Dugdale's 1870s inquiry into whether pauperism, alongside other elements of degeneracy and criminality, might be hereditary. Footnote 58, Dugdale, The Dukes. End of footnote. These projects have often had racist motivations. Ernest Houghton's study of the link between biology and crime involved comparing prison populations to those outside of prison and concluding that some races were inherently criminal and should be counted as inferior. He began with overtly racist commitments and assumed without question that the process by which some people ended up in prison in 1930s America would be neutral and free of bias. Footnote 59, Houghton, Crime and Man, end of footnote. The goal of reducing criminality has also been implicated in the liberal use of involuntary sterilizations, particularly in the United States. Targeted crimes or sins included homosexuality and masturbation. Forced sterilization was associated with racism and eugenics alongside more well-meaning goals. Footnote 60. See Largent, Breeding Contempt, especially pages 11 to 38, end of footnote. One of the earliest explicit statements of the claim that violence is a public health problem is from Vernon Mark and Frank Irwin, footnote 61. Mark Irwin and Sweet, The Role of Brain Disease in Riots and Urban Violence. They, along with William Sweet, proposed initially in response to urban riots that psychosurgery should be considered for use on large segments of the population as a means of preventing crime. Footnote 61, Mark and Irvin, Violence and the Brain, page 160. They, along with William Sweet, proposed initially in response to urban riots that psychosurgery should be considered for use on large segments of the population as a means of preventing crime. Footnote 62. Mark Irvin and Sweet, Role of Brain Disease in Urban Riots and Urban Violence. End of footnote. There is some justice in Preeta Bregin's description of such proposals as a sort of psychiatric totalitarianism. Footnote 63. Bregin, Psychosurgery for Political Purposes, page 847. End of footnote. Worries about the psychiatric totalitarian potential of associating crime with health are thus not unfounded. Medicine has often been a mask for social control and has been associated with appalling policies and interventions, often inflicted without consent on those deviating from norms. As Emily McTernan argues, the sort of history ought to provoke some moral concern, particularly about the sorts of medical interventions for deviants that might involve neurointerventions. Footnote 67, McTernan, Those Who Forget the Past. End of footnote. 4.2, The Dark History of Medicine Itself. It is evident, even from this very brief summary, that the history here is troubling. Nonetheless, I want to suggest that what is troubling about it actually has very little to do with treating crime as a public health problem. The trouble arises from a morally suspect approach to medicine more generally. Many of, page 25. The treatment for illnesses that most of us accept ought to be counted within the realm of medicine also have a dark history. Perhaps the problem is not that such illnesses, along with criminality, are regarded as matters of public health, but that governments and experts have often exercised poor moral judgment about medicine. Negative reinforcement in the form of aversive stimuli, such as electric shocks and paralysing drugs, has been used to treat not only those behaviours regarded as criminal, but also true medical conditions. For example, emetic drugs and succinylcholine chloride have been used in conditioning treatments for alcoholism. Footnote 65. Schwitz-Gabel, Development and Legal Regulation of Coercive Behaviour Modification Techniques with Offenders, page 14. End of footnote. Forced and unanaesthetised electroconvulsive therapy, ECT, and psychosurgeries such as frontal lobotomies have been used to treat mental health problems, including depression, anxiety, addiction, and schizophrenia. For a long time, it was rare to seek the consent of patients at all. Footnote 66. Ottersen and Fink, Ethics in Electroconvulsive Therapy, pages 33-48. End of footnote. Even after laws were introduced requiring informed consent for psychosurgery, which was as late as the 1950s, the extent to which patients were able to count as meaningfully consenting is contentious. Footnote 67, Raz, the Lobotomy Letters, pages 69-100, end of footnote. Forced sterilisation was used to treat various mental health conditions. For example, hysterectomies were used to treat women's hysteria, which could include psychiatric conditions and epilepsy. Forced sterilisations were also seen as appropriate for preventing the spread of drunkenness. Some authors advocated castration to stop the breeding of imbeciles and paupers. Footnote 70, Baldwin, Whipping and Castration as Punishments for Crime, page 382. End of footnote. Unsurprisingly, some critics of the use of medical approaches in relation to crime are also sceptical about the treatment of mental illness across the board, arguing that the mind should be entirely outside of the sphere of healthcare. Satz has written critiques of both the use of medical methods in relation to crime and the inclusion of mental health within the realm of medicine. This stance on mental health is rarely regarded as plausible. Moreover, it seems to misidentify the source of moral concern. When we contemplate what is wrong with forcing hysterectomies on non-consenting women as a treatment for epilepsy, the thing that troubles us is not that epilepsy is being erroneously regarded as a medical condition. Epilepsy plausibly is a medical condition. Clearly that, page 26, alone does not entail that treating it with forced hysterectomies is justifiable, either morally or medically. The danger of patients having treatments inflicted on them without informed consent is something that has increasingly come under scrutiny in medicine. Elizabeth Sinons argues that forced psychotropic treatments should be regarded as a cruel and unusual punishment, both in penal and in non-penal settings such as psychiatric units. Footnote 72, Simmons, Mental Patients' Right to Refuse Drugs, end of footnote. We now accept, contra Morris, that treatment can be cruel in addition to merely being painful. Many previously commonplace practices in psychiatry are rejected now precisely on this basis, and we recognise, also contra Morris, the need for procedural safeguards. It is also far from obvious that the dangers that arise in relation to medical treatment of psychiatric ailments are fundamentally different from those that arise in relation to treatment of physical health conditions. There was no clear notion of informed consent in any area of medicine until the 1950s, and there is evidence that before that point, while some practitioners consulted patients on whether they wanted to undergo procedures, others regularly failed to. Across all areas of medicine, this has improved through increased moral scrutiny and legislation. But there is probably nothing inherently special about medicine here. If we closely examine the history of marriage, religious organisations, educational establishments, families, workplaces, military organisations, or virtually any other human social institution, we find similar patterns. Frequent abuses of power and exploitation of the vulnerable, with little regard for individual autonomy or consent until increased moral scrutiny brings about legislative changes. While medicine has often been an instrument of social control, so has pretty much everything. 5. Ethics, responsibility and public health. If almost everything has a dark history, this has some implications for how we ought to respond to the dark history of the association between crime and public health. Instead of seeking to stop anything from falling within the remit of public health, we should instead ask why public health initiatives have often been unethical and corrupt. The answer is not, I suspect, because such initiatives are not governed by principles of retributive blame. After all, retributive punishment plainly has an even darker history. Forced unanaesthetised ECT, page 27, is probably less dehumanising than being publicly disembowelled, burned alive or crucified. It is also a false dichotomy to suppose that if we do not view something as a matter of retributive blame, we must view it as entirely outside of the realm of taken responsibility. It is false that if we do not treat alcoholism as a moral failing that ought to be punished, then we must instead support forcing alcoholics into programs of aversive conditioning and inflicting horrors on them like electrocution or succinylcholine chloride. From an ethical perspective, there is a critical difference between emphasising public policy measures that reduce the risk to vulnerable groups of developing certain problems, whether that be criminality, obesity, addictions, heart disease, seasonal flu or whatever, and policy measures that needlessly weaken an agent's abilities to assume control over their own future behaviours. The reason why Caruso does not move from a lack of retributive blame directly to an endorsement of mass incarceration for all of those who fall into various risk categories, or to a programme of coercive drugging or conditioning of offenders, is because scepticism about retributive blame does not entail that the capacity of agents to exercise future-directed commitment with respect to their own behaviour is no longer a valid moral concern. Nor does it entail that consent is never required for any effective intervention. If we think that these are valid moral concerns, then we have every reason to class these strategies as unethical methods of both crime prevention and medical treatment. 6. Conclusion. This paper has sought to challenge a common source of uneasiness about treating crime as a public health problem. It is an uneasiness that derives from a history of medicalising crime that is indeed ethically problematic. The worry is that once we put crime within the remit of medicine, we must endorse impersonal, manipulative and dehumanising measures of tackling crime. The mistake, I maintain, does not consist in our putting crime within the broad remit of public health, but in supposing that impersonal, manipulative and dehumanising measures would become morally acceptable the moment that crime, or anything else, is placed within the boundaries of public health. The problem is that we have often had a lax moral approach to health measures. Critiques that continue to be highly influential, such as Strawson's and Morris's, emerged in the 1960s after several decades, if not centuries, in which standard practices for dealing with mental health problems included measures that we now view as shockingly unethical and inhumane. Perhaps at that time it seemed obvious, as Morris contended, that we could treat those with illnesses, page 28, like animals, ignore their consent, inflict cruel treatments, etc. But we should not have thought that this was justifiable in the name of medicine then, and we need not suppose that this is an acceptable approach to medicine now. One major virtue of Caruso's policy suggestions is that they reflect an ethically sensitive picture of what good public health policy should look like. Public health measures across the board should adhere to defensible ethical standards. While many of these standards are tied to some recognition of the moral importance of protecting and cultivating the capacities that underlie taken responsibility or future-directed commitment, they're not tied essentially to retributive blame. Footnote 74. I am grateful to Dr. Tuomas K. Pernu, Professor Victor Tadros, Dr. Robin Repko-Waller, anonymous reviewers and JESP's anonymous associate editor for incredibly helpful comments on earlier drafts of this paper. End footnote. References. Baldwin S., Whipping and Castration as Punishments for Crime, Yale Law Journal, 8, number 9, 1899, pages 371-86. Bregin, Peter R., Psychosurgery for Political Purposes, Duquesne Law Review, 13, number 4, 1975, pages 841-62. Burgess, Anthony, A Clockwork Orange, Banned Book Series, Pay-Per-View, 1962. Cartwright, Samuel A. Report on the Diseases and Physical Peculiarities of the Negro Race. New Orleans Medical and Surgical Journal, 7, 1851, pages 691-715. Caruso, Greg D., Free Will Skepticism and Criminal Behaviour, A Public Health Quarantine Model, Southwest Philosophy Review, 32, number 1, 2016, pages 25-48. And Public Health and Safety, The Social Determinants of Health and Criminal Behaviour, Research Links Books, 2017. And Rejecting Retributivism, Free Will, Punishment and Criminal Justice, Cambridge University Press, 2021. Caruso, Greg D. and Dirk Pairboom, Moral Responsibility Reconsidered, Cambridge University Press, 2022. And A Non-Punitive Alternative to Retributive Punishment, in the Routledge Handbook of Philosophy and Science of Punishment, edited by Farifa Kurt, Elizabeth Shaw and Bruce N. Waller, Routledge, 2020. Chang, Virginia W. and Nicholas A. Christakis, Medical Modelling of Obesity, A Transition from Action to Experience in a 20th Century American Medical Textbook. Sociology of Health and Illness, 24, number 2, 2002, pages 151-77. Conrad, Peter, Medicine as an Instrument of Social Control, Consequences for Society, in Deviance and Medicalization from Badness to Sickness, edited by Peter Conrad and Joseph W. Schneider, Temple University Press, 1992. De Ruyter, Dorrit, The Virtue of Taking Responsibility, Educational Philosophy and Theory, 34, number 1, 2002, 25-35. Dugdale, R.L., The Dukes, A Study in Crime, Pauperism, Disease and Heredity, G.P. Putnam's and Son, 1877. Elzane, Nadine, Undetermined Choices, Luck and the Enhancement Problem, Erkentis, 88, number 7, 2023, pages 2827-46. Enoch, David, Being Responsible, Taking Responsibility and Penumbral Agency, in Luck, Value and Commitment, Themes from the Ethics of Bernard Williams, edited by Ulrika Hua and Gerald Lang, Oxford University Press, 2012. Fadden, Ruth R., Tom L. Beauchamp and Nancy M. P. King, A History and Theory of Informed Consent, Oxford University Press, 1986. Farone, Stephen, Psychiatry and Political Repression in the Soviet Union, American Psychologist, 37, number 10, 1982, pages 1105-12. Fisher, John Martin and Mark Revisa, Responsibility and Control, A Theory of Moral Responsibility, Cambridge University Press, 1998. Frankfurt, Harry G., Philosophy, Freedom of the Will and the Concept of a Person, Journal of Philosophy, 68, number 1, 1971, pages 5-20. Gaydon, Jerry, Rehabilitating Responsibility, Journal of Philosophy of Education, 24, number 1, 1990, pages 27-39. Hobbes, Thomas, Of Liberty and Necessity, in Hobbes and Bramall on Liberty and Necessity, edited by Vere Chappell, Cambridge University Press, 1999. Houghton, Ernest Albert, Crime and Man, Harvard University Press, 1939. Hume, David, An Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, edited by Tom L. Beauchamp, Oxford University Press, 1999, original publication 1748. And A Treatise of Human Nature, edited by David Fate Norton and Mary J. Norton, Oxford University Press, 2000, original publication 1740. Kelly, Erin I., Criminal Justice Without Retribution, Journal of Philosophy, 106, number 8, 2009, pages 440-62. And The Limits of Bright Blame, Rethinking Punishment and Responsibility, Harvard University Press, 2018. Kittry, Nicholas N., The Right to be Different, Deviance and Enforced Therapy, John Hopkins Press, 1971. Largent, Mark A., Breeding Contempt, The History of Coerced Sterilization in the United States, Rutgers University Press, 2011. Lavater, Johann Caspar, Essays on Physiognomy, For the Promotion of the Knowledge and the Love of Mankind, Volume 1, C. Whittingham, 1804. Lemos, John, Free Will's Value, Criminal Justice, Pride and Love, Routledge, 2023. And A Moral/Pragmatic Defence of Just Deserts Responsibility, Journal of Information Ethics, 28, number 1, 2019, pages 73-94. Levi, Ken M., Let's Not Do Responsibility Skepticism, Journal of Applied Philosophy, 40, number 3, 2023, pages 1-15. Mark V.H. and F.R. Irvin, Violence and the Brain, Harper and Row, 1970. Mark V.H., W.H. Sweet and F.R. Irvin, The Role of Brain Disease in Riots and Urban Violence, Journal of the American Medical Association, 203, number 5, 1968, pages 368-69. McTernan, Emily, Those Who Forget the Past, An Ethical Challenge from the History of Treating Deviance, In Treatment for Crime, Philosophical Essays on Neurointerventions in Criminal Justice, Engaging Philosophy, edited by David Burks and Thomas Douglas, Oxford University Press, 2018. Moran, Richard, The Search for the Born Criminal and the Medical Control of Criminality, in Deviance and Medicalization, From Badness to Sickness, edited by Peter Conrad and Joseph W. Schneider, Temple University Press, 1992. Morris, Herbert, Persons and Punishment, Monist, 54, No. 2, 1968, pages 475 to 501. Morse, Stephen J., Compatibilist Criminal Law, in The Future of Punishment, edited by Thomas A. Nadelhofer, Oxford University Press, 2013. Malanathan, Sendil, and Eldar Shafir, Scarcity, Why Having Too Little Means So Much, Macmillan, 2013. Otterson, Jan Otto, and Max Fink, Ethics in Electroconvulsive Therapy, Brunner Routledge, 2012. Pepper, Gillian V, and Daniel Nettle, The Behavioural Constellation of Deprivation, Causes and Consequences, Behavioural and Brain Sciences, 40, 2017. Pearboom, Dirk, Free Will, Agency and Meaning in Life, Oxford University Press, 2014. And Free Will, Love and Anger, Ideas e Valores, 58, number 141, 2006, pages 169 to 89. And Incapacitation, Reintegration and Limited Deterrence, Neuroethics, 13, number 1, 2020, pages 87 to 97, and Living Without Free Will, Cambridge University Press, 2006. Pearboom, Dirk and Greg D. Caruso, Hard Incompatibilist Existentialism, Neuroscience, Punishment and Meaning in Life, in Neuroexistentialism, Meaning, Morals and Purpose in the Age of Neuroscience, edited by Greg D. Caruso and Owen Flanagan, Oxford University Press, 2018. Pickard, Hannah, Responsibility Without Blame, Empathy and Effective Treatment of Personality Disorder, Philosophy, Psychiatry, Psychology, number 18, number 3, 2011, pages 209-24. And Responsibility Without Blame, Therapy, Philosophy, Law, Prison Service Journal, 213, 2014, pages 10-16. And Rethinking Justice, The Clinical Model of Responsibility Without Blame, Howard League for Penal Reforms, Early Academics Network Bulletin, 36, 2018, pages 4 to 10. Raz Mikal, The Lobotomy Letters, The Making of American Psychosurgery, University of Rochester Press, 2013. Scanlon, T.M., Interpreting Blame, in Blame, Its Nature and Norms, edited by Justin D. Coates and Neil A. Tognazzini, Oxford University Press, 2012. Schwitzgebel, Ralph K., Development and Legal Regulation of Coercive Behaviour Modification Techniques with Offenders, National Institutes of Mental Health, Centre for Studies of Crime and Delinquency, 1971. Sen Amartya, Development as Freedom, Oxford University Press, 1999. Spurzheim, J.G., The Physiognomical System of Dr. Gorns and Spurzheim, 2nd edition, Baldwin, Craddock and Joy, 1815. Strawson, Peter F., Freedom and Resentment, Proceedings of the British Academy, 48, 1962, pages 187-211. Simmons, Elizabeth, Mental Patients' Right to Refuse Drugs, Involuntary Medication as Cruel and Unusual Punishment, Hastings Constitutional Law Quarterly, 7, 1979, 701-38. Sats, Thomas, S., Ideology and Insanity, Essays on the Psychiatric Dehumanization of Man, Syracuse University Press, 1991. and Law, Liberty and Psychiatry, an inquiry into the social uses of mental health practices, Macmillan, 1963. Tadros, Victor, Treatment and Accountability, in Lanton Lectures in Bioethics, 2016 to 2022, Assisted Suicide Responsibility and Pandemic Ethics, edited by Hom Lam Lee, Palgrave Macmillan, 2024. Vargas, Manuel, The Problem with Tracing, Midwest Studies in Philosophy, 29, No. 1, 2005, pages 269 to 91. Waller, Bruce, Against Moral Responsibility, Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press, 2011. And Virtue Unrewarded, Morality Without Moral Responsibility, Philosophia, 31, 2004, pages 427 to 47. Watson, Gary, Free Agency, Journal of Philosophy, 72, No. 8, 1975, pages 205 to 20, and Two Faces of Responsibility, Philosophical Topics, 24, No. 2, 1996, pages 227 to 48. Williams, Bernard, Moral Luck, Aristotelian Society Supplementary, Volume 50, 1976, pages 115 to 35. Wolfe, Susan, Freedom Within Reason, Oxford University Press, 1990.